Hello, loyal podcast listeners. This is Heather, and I wanted to quickly let everybody know that these general conference reviews are being cross-posted on Mormon Expression and the Mormon Expositor in order to cross-advertise. So if you are a Mormon Expression loyalist and you have not listened to Mormon Expositor yet, please come check us out at mormonexpositor.com. And if you're checking this out on Mormon Expositor and for some reason you've never heard of Mormon Expression before, you should run on over to that website, mormonexpression.com, and check out the wonderful podcasts that have been posted there over the last few years. Thank you for listening, and I hope you guys enjoy these conference reviews. Everybody, this is Heather, and today I am hosting the review for the General Relief Society meeting that was held on the 29th of September, 2012. And with me today, I have two people from the Feminist Mormon Housewives podcast, Alisa and Lindsay. Hello, guys.
Hi. Hello.
Or ladies, I guess, not guys.
Sometimes I'm a guy.
So why don't we go ahead and just dive right in? The meeting was conducted by Linda Burton, who was called to be the new General RS president this year, right? Back in April?
Yep.
Yeah.
So this is her first dog and pony show. Okay, so let's talk about the first talk, which was by, again, Linda Burton. She basically spoke about the atonement. How did you guys feel about this talk?
Well, I found that I'm going to be using lots of clicks tonight to go with the theme of Jesus, hand carts, and the primary voice. All three of those made an appearance in all of the talks. We had Jesus, hand carts, and the primary voice was in full force tonight. Did you guys notice that?
Yes.
Yeah.
In fact, my husband looked up when he was on the computer, and he looked up and he was like, oh, it's a different lady talking, because it sounded the same to him. And I don't mean to make fun of that, but like, for some reason, it was super, super strong tonight.
I agree.
Yeah, I thought with Julie B. Beck, like, that it was starting to go out of vogue, but it looks like it's back again.
Well, it's back with style, baby. But yeah, the atonement was in every single talk, and I don't know if that's because of the Mormon moment, you know, like, focus on nor Christian. But good messages, for the most part, about that, but I definitely atonement heavy in this talk.
I kind of thought that was a relief, as opposed to when the second talk started and she opened with duty. I was like, okay, here we go. But it seemed like the whole way through, instead of exacerbating sensitive issues, they, like you said, focused on the atonement. I thought it was kind of refreshing.
Well, she talked about packing the handcart, and I immediately thought of Carolyn Pearson's, you know, poem that all of us disaffected members like to use. So that was kind of funny. But mm-hmm. She talked about what we can bring in our hand cart, because we can only bring a certain amount of things. And she gave us three things, and one of them was strength in the family and understanding the atonement and knowing that we're daughters of God. Those were the things she packed in her hand cart. Did I get that right?
Yeah, and help those in need, I guess, was a part of that as well.
Yeah, she had basically three principles of the atonement. The first one is, all that is unfair about life can be made right through the atonement of Christ. The second point was, there is power in the atonement to overcome the natural man or woman and become true disciples. And the third one is that the atonement is the greatest evidence we have of God's love for his children. Those were her three basic points in that talk.
I've got to say, I don't understand number one. What is the doctrinal basis for saying that the atonement makes everything even? Has that always been in a principle of the church and I just missed it?
No, I think that was a theme that I heard several times tonight. In accordance with, she also called the plan of happiness the perfect plan of happiness, mm-hmm. which I'm sure that's been said before, but I thought it was interesting because it was like, you know, everything is made whole, everything is made fair, everything is made right, everything is made perfect. That was made a few times. So I don't exactly know where that's coming from.
Well, I remember growing up and hearing, you know, in particular about raising children, obviously, whatever you don't get in this life will be returned to you 10,000 times over or whatever. And so don't worry about your life not maybe working out perfectly here, because you'll get to have all those wonderful things in heaven. And but I've never heard of it linked to the atonement.
Well, what I think is a little bit problematic about that kind of statement, that, well, the atonement makes all of the inequality and the suffering of this life okay, is that for some people it can be kind of a pass to kind of say, oh, well, since through the atonement everything is going to be made right someday, you don't really have to worry so much about fixing inequalities and injustices that exist in today's world. Just, you know, let Christ take care of that. Let somebody else take care of that. We don't have to worry about big issues like abject poverty, you know, or other serious issues like that.
Well, and I have a theory, and this is completely just a theory, but it was a few months ago when there was a call from the Old Relief Society presidency. They wanted to talk to women and have a Q&A online. Do you guys remember hearing about that? Anyway, so they put out a call, and Feminist Warren Housewives was sort of involved. We started writing all these questions, and a lot of the questions online were, women are in pain, we're hurting, when are you going to help us? When are you going to address our pain? And of course, most of the pain that we were referring to were hard issues like feminist issues, equality issues, depression issues, female issues, women's issues. And there were like 650 comments before they closed the thread. And when the Q&A came out, they briefly addressed that, like, oh, women are in pain and we don't want you to be in pain anymore. But I found that theme running through tonight, and I wonder if that's carried over, because there was so much of this like discussion about, if you are in pain, Christ can make you whole. And it was said over and over and over again. So I don't know if it had anything to do with the fact that women are starting to say, you know, we're hurting, and they're misunderstanding. It's just a theory. Sorry to go off topic, but.
Oh, no, I think that could very well be.
I think that coming at this from a secular perspective, as I do, so her talk was very much centered around the atonement, as was the majority of the talks tonight. And I do feel that ultimately there is psychological value in the atonement. In some respects, I think it helps people who believe in it to be more optimistic. It helps you to let go of the past and kind of focus on things that you can't control in the past and focus more on the future. And it helps you to also feel that you are more in control of your personal destiny than perhaps maybe you really are. But I feel that it's a lot like a placebo pill, in that if you know how it works, it stops working.
Right.
That kind of thing. I mean, for me personally, I have a hard time believing in the atonement, just because it seems clear to me from the historical record or the textual record that the atonement is kind of a social construction that was created by early Christians after Christ's death to kind of make sense of Christ's death. So even though I think that it's a useful social fiction, it's still a social fiction for me. But at the same time, I don't want to like put down people's placebo effect. Does that make sense?
So. Yes.
There was something, maybe you guys can help me articulate this. This is what I was feeling listening to it. Now, I remember I would listen to this and feel what I thought was like the strong sense of the spirit listening to it. No matter what was said, I think what I was feeling was emotion that was kind of rooted in guilt. Like she told in this talk the story of a woman in Chile with two kids who had put her past behind her because of the atonement, and how the atonement can, you know, help you move forward and stay on that path and put all your sins away. And listening, you know, before, as a true believer, I think I would always say, you know, I would internalize any tiny little mistake I would made and think, oh, Christ can help me. So it was kind of circular. So I'd listen to conference and think it was a spirit and feel more guilt, but also feel relieved of my guilt. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's like it almost creates the cure for the very disease that it's causing. Yes. You know, it's saying you need to feel guilt and shame. Like she made that image of the of being in the pit of sin. So we're in this state of guilt and shame caused by people telling us that we need to be in guilt and shame, and then they provide us the cure for the very disease that they've caused. Is that
Yeah, that's exactly what I was feeling. Thank you.
So the next talk was by Carol M. Stevens, who is the first counselor in the General Relief Society presidency. She basically talked about the atonement again. I kind of felt like all these talks were a little mushy as far as like a central theme or like being able to write out the title of the talk.
I agree.
I think Sister Burton kind of outlined the way the meeting was going to go, that the first one was going to be about the atonement. The second one was going to be about covenants. So I think this one was supposed to be about cleaving to our covenants. I think that was supposed to be the theme.
Yeah. Now that I'm thinking about it, I think you're right. As I was listening, this isn't really so much about the talk, it's just an observation I have about faith for or belief versus non-belief. She said in there in her talk that when our hearts are changed at baptism, and it affects what we listen to, what we read, and what we wear, and all that kind of stuff. And I think that it kind of illustrates that if you believe, then you really do think that there is a change in you, not maybe physical, but metaphysical, but a real actual change that affects the way that you perceive the world and understand the things around you. And so if you're disbelieving, then it literally is like being tricked. I'm not explaining this very well. Do you guys understand what I mean?
You know, I've talked about this before on podcasts, but I relate it to the same thing of that light, that Mormon light that we talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I internalized it. And once, you know, someone stops believing, they lose that light, they lose that glow. And with that, they lose their ability to discern things with the spirit. And
exactly. It's not as if believers think, well, I've examined this evidence or I have had these experiences and they lead me to conclude X. And so if somebody doesn't believe that, they don't look at that and see these people have examined this evidence or haven't had these experiences and they've concluded Y. It's that they are using different perceptions based on this changed heart and these changes within you that people who no longer believe are no longer paying attention to. It's
your peepstone of belief.
Yeah.
The quote she kept using was from Zina D. Young about being wide awake, awakened to our duties, awakened to our true selves, you know, and that I think that word means different things to different people on different faith scales.
Good point. For me, I felt like the talk, I don't think this is what she intended, but for me, I saw the whole talk as a theme of Mormon separatism, if you will. I feel like, so referencing what you were talking about, Heather, she talked about how when you take on covenants, you change and you leave the world and you become special, you become unique. So it was kind of a talk about Mormon uniqueness and specialness and having an identity. And that's all good. It's good for creating like a good feeling of identity, as I said. But it has a flip side, in my opinion. I think that those messages of us versus the world and those kind of themes of Mormon separateness, I think it has the flip side of saying that we need to distrust the world and we need to remove ourselves from the world and not engage in the world. We need to not, you know, associate with people who are not like us or with people who have different perspectives or different ways of looking at the world. And I find that to be very problematic because I think that people are made better by interacting with a diverse array of different types of people. So I find the idea of Mormon separateness and being separate from the world to be problematic.
I agree. And she even said in there that people will walk away and walk back to the world. So she definitely did create a separation between the faithful good and the outside bad.
Can I talk about something that struck me?
Sure.
Quite strongly. Well, first of all, in all of these, they were definitely pulling heavy out of Daughters of My Kingdom. I think on purpose. I think if they were given any instruction at all, it was focus on the Savior and focus on Daughters of My Kingdom,
right,
the history stuff, because that seemed to appear quite a bit. But she talked about the women's pull on the trek.
Mm-hmm.
And for those who don't know, that's when you're on a pioneer trek with the youth and to replicate the men going off to the Mormon Battalion, the men all stand by the sidelines while the women have to pull the handcart up the hill, right? Did I describe that accurately?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And a lot of the feminist Mormons that I know have problems with this because it suggests that, you know, these women are so weak and it's such a trial just to be women by yourselves. And there's just a few problems there. Anyway, so she tells a story and she tells it and she's telling it in tears most of the mm-hmm. time, and how all these women pulled together, and she shows a picture of the men in her stake. They're all standing by the sidelines with their hats over their hearts. And, you know, I've been through this. It's a very powerful, spiritual, emotional experience when you do it. But she was saying that if we were to liken that experience to our day, these women working together, seeing the men and their priesthood, which is given to all of us, is a reminder that we are never alone, which is kind of funny because they left the girls alone to pull the stuff up the hill.
Well, yeah, the other thing that I think is kind of, I mean, aside from the fact that the whole Trek thing is like this weird sort of simulated spiritual experience, it kind of is going back to what I was saying, that it is yet another kind of theme of Mormon identity and Mormon separateness, because ultimately the Trek West was the kind of ultimate symbol of Mormons withdrawing from the world and wanting to be their own people and kind of walling themselves off from the world. That's what the Trek was all about. It was about withdrawing from the world. And I also think it's interesting how the Trek kind of represents this idea of adversity and opposition as being a sign that you are in the right, because the fact that the saints were facing all this persecution and that's what caused them to leave, and also that saints today face persecution from the world or things like that, kind of reinforces that idea that because you're being persecuted, that you're on the Lord's side. That proves that you're right. You know, it's the idea of Satan is fighting to keep us from the temple, you know, and that proves that the temple is true or right or things like that. So
yeah, I don't know if you guys picked up on this, but she was talking about how, you know, the men in our day the men back then had to leave the women for a variety of reasons, which isn't exactly factually accurate. It's not like the women were left completely alone. But anyway, she said, you know, some men had to go on missions and some men had to, I can't remember the reason she left. But then she said, comparing it to our day, that there were men that didn't fulfill their covenants. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was interesting. And it made me think of, you know, all those women who are saddened that their husbands just aren't living up to their priesthood duties.
It was a little male dig, wasn't it?
Yeah. Anyway, continue.
I'm done.
Yeah, that's really all I had about that one as well. The next talk was by Linda Reeves, who is the second counselor in the Relief Society presidency. And her talk was basically about Jesus knows you're there. You're not alone. He's aware of what you're going through. And did I pick up on that right?
Yep. And she got very emotional too, mm-hmm. speaking about the pain that women feel. And what I know that a lot of your listeners will like this. She said, "Dear sisters, our Heavenly Father and Savior Jesus Christ knows us and loves us, and He basically feels your pain, and He knows that your husband will find a job and your wandering children will come back."
Yeah.
I thought about all of your moms weeping.
Well, to me, this illustrates basically why I think the idea of loving Heavenly Father or Savior is so appealing to people, is that there's some sort of cognitive base in our human brains that really needs connection to society and to each other. And it's comforting to think that there's this person that's out there watching over you, understanding what you're going through and caring about you. But I thought that this talk also represented what Elisa was talking about in the last talk or the one before it, about kind of giving people like off the hook. She at the very beginning of her talk, she talked about going to a museum and meeting this woman who was an only child whose parents were dead, didn't have a husband or children. And she received this overwhelming feeling that woman was not alone because God knew of her. And I thought, well, that's a nice idea, but it seemed more, I mean, I'm really not trying to criticize, but I just feel like that was helping you feel better about knowing that there's pain in the world. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And this is the appeal of God to me, because mm-hmm. I know it's like a small kind of myopic view of God, but it's still one that I cling to at, you know, when I need comfort and things like that, because I do like the idea of, you know, someone recognizing and validating my pain, someone understanding the problems that I'm going through in a better way than I can understand them. That is very comforting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I felt that her talk was really good for what you know, within the Mormon context and the Mormon worldview, I thought it was really actually very good and very powerful. I thought hers was one of the better talks of the evening. And I also have a hard time kind of being critical of people sharing deeply intense personal experiences. Mm-hmm. At the same time, though, so I will mention that I watched this in a stake center and everybody was weeping during her whole talk because she was talking about an experience when her husband was close to death and how the atonement kind of helped her through it. And the same thing when her 17-year-old daughter died and how that helped her through with the atonement. And so, yeah, everybody was weeping. Everybody was feeling really emotional. And I have to admit, I was feeling emotional, too. And in the past, I would have interpreted it as the spirit. But I know about mirror neurons and that mirror neurons basically work to help you to kind of feel what the person is feeling when they're speaking and sharing something deeply personal and things like that. So it's hard for me to fully trust my own emotions as that being something like the spirit now that I know about things like mirror neurons. So
yeah, I kind of had the same thought as well. I guess I don't have a problem with people feeling comfort in their trials, and especially when they're going through horrible things like losing a loved one. But I look at the situation with the woman who was alone, and I think instead of comforting ourselves with the notion that there's some man in the sky who cares about this woman, why don't we say, wow, there's suffering and loneliness in the world, and we're capable of creating structures and systems that could alleviate that. So why don't we put our efforts in there? It's more like, oh, well, that makes me feel better and I can move on now without being sad for this woman. That was the only part of the talk that kind of bugged me. So
here's my last quibble with this particular talk. It was I don't know if you were watching it visually, but they had a cutaway when she was telling the story of Lazarus. Mm-hmm. And in the cutaway, they showed Christ like just holding Mary and Martha and trying to just comfort them. And having just spent the last month studying gender norms in ancient Christianity or in Judaism at that time, I was like, oh my gosh, that's so anachronistic. They would never allow that to happen in that society. That would have been seen as completely unchaste. And it would have just, so, you know, the cutaways are problematic and how we kind of impose these kind of Mormon anachronistic worldviews on the past. But that was a minor quibble, but it did bother me a little.
See, and I saw that clip and that those are the clips that get me. They're like, you know, old seminary, heavy-handed, spiritual, emotional hook right there. I was like, oh, familiar. Feels good.
Yeah, and for me as a scholar, I was horrified. I was like, that's not how it would have been. They would have stoned them if she had done that to Jesus, you know.
Maybe anyway. That was in the lost part that we didn't read later. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
So the last talk was by Henry Eyring. His talk was odd to me. It was basically the same thing, the atonement. And then at the end, he focused a lot on caregivers.
Yeah, that's odd. Yeah. I thought it was scattered.
Yes, definitely. Basically, the one criticism I have of this is that they brought up the Willie Martin situation.
And I put that down too.
Yeah. And that with the reference to Trek, it just, the constant glorification of that bothers me. Because I did some studying for an episode of The Expositor about millennialism and the idea that the Savior's about to return and how it affected the church along the way. And there was apparently this feeling that was being pushed in the church that if you have the opportunity to come to Zion, regardless of how much of a horrible trial it would be to get there, and regardless of the fact that you might die along the way, if you don't take that opportunity, then you will be screwed over when Jesus comes back. He's going to be here any day and you'll be on the outside of the gates and too bad for you. And then you had these leaders who the program wasn't properly funded, the people starved, they froze to death, and even with those tragedies, they still kept doing it for a while, bringing these poor people out with these handcarts. And I think it, more than anything, it's a lesson in horrible things that can happen when you trust so much in what a leader says is best for you.
He was said, and you know, Brigham Young sent the saints back to help those struggling with the handcarts, and I thought, as if that was like a good thing to be celebrated. And I thought, well, of course he did. They all messed up big time. They had to go fix their huge, huge mistake.
Yeah, they were in that situation because of him. Well, and all of the leaders at that time.
So it's like you're basically accusing them of cherry picking the good examples and completely ignoring all the bad ones, right?
It's misunderstanding history
completely. Yeah. It's glorifying something that should, a very somber lesson should be taken from, not all of this faith promoting, oh, this was such an awesome thing. It was a tragedy. It was a horrible thing. It should not be glorified.
I think it was Sister Burton talked about it in her talk too, about how the saints sacrificed so much. And she brought up this visual. I think it was Burton that said, burying your baby in a bread box. Did you?
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, I love my pioneer history, and I love all of these stories, and I feel bad for the sacrifice, but she did the same thing, saying, but these people kept coming because they knew it was the right thing to do, and that's what gave them the strength to bury their baby in a bread box, as if the people didn't have any other choice, you know?
Right. Well, and she also quoted Holland. They didn't come out here for a program. And I thought that was kind of a dig at people who are trying to make the church work as a cultural societal institution as opposed to like a singular truth eternal thing, basically liberal noms or whatever you want to say. And I don't know, the whole thing is
that reinforced it. You thought it was against that? I thought it was saying, yeah, it's not about the correlated church, it's about the gospel.
Well, yeah, I think, well, to me it says people didn't come out here because they wanted to join a nice organization. They came out here because the church is true and it has eternal consequences. And I see that as a dig at people who are trying to make it work when they no longer believe. But I think in the believer context, yes, it is it's about personal faith type of thing. Did you guys have any other thoughts on his talk?
I actually didn't mind it. I liked a lot of aspects for it. From when he quoted, quoted Lucy Mack Smith. So it's nice to hear a female being quoted mm-hmm. with authority, and he organized his talk around her quote. Like, that's nice. I'd like to see more females being quoted in official settings. But he told a story and it was quite moving. And everybody in my stake center was gasping and they were really into the story where he was talking about his daughter who started to hemorrhage when she was 6 months pregnant, and how a visiting teacher just happened to come by right at that moment to take her to the hospital. And she didn't have an appointment. She just happened to come. Mm-hmm. It was an example for him of like the power of the church and the Spirit Ghost and things like that. And I really feel bad when I rain on people's spiritual experiences, especially really intense, cool spiritual experiences like that. But at the same time, I can't help but feel that it's another example of confirmation bias. You know, we remember the times when these coincidences, if you will, happen, but we neglect all the times the bad things, when it doesn't work out, when the visiting teacher didn't come to take you to the hospital. So I think that's an important point to keep in mind.
Well, and the only other thing I wanted to say that I really like, speaking to kind of what you said, Elisa, they use the term covenant sisters. And I actually really like that idea that, you know, women are tied together and that they should, you know, lift each other and pull each other. And I think that that's like the spirit of what the Relief Society is trying to be about, mm-hmm. but not quite getting. And this is what I struggle with when I hear these kind of talks, is they talk about this marvelous work that the women are doing and this great work that's rolling forward in the church. And when I was active, I believed that. But now that I look outside of it, I think, what really are we doing? What are you doing that's so great, that's helping women? Bringing casseroles and dinners to people is great. There's nothing wrong with that. But there's so much women's issues out there that really need to be addressed. So anyway, that's kind of my gripe.
Well, and societal things as well. I have to wonder what the church would look like, or not necessarily the church, but the Relief Society and their function would look like if they hadn't been, I'm about to use a male term because I can't think of a better one, castrated in the 70s. It was the 70s, right?
Yeah.
I think, I don't know if I've told you guys this on podcast for your listeners, but when I went and saw Laurel Thatcher Ulrich talk about Daughters of My Kingdom, mm-hmm. she refers to the timeline in the back. She tells everyone to open it up, and she says, Daughters of My Kingdom is a history of the disappearance of Relief Society. Because if you look at the timeline, there's all these cool things that the women are doing. They're organizing these huge humanitarian efforts. They're getting helping get the right to vote. And then from like correlation on, there's like a page. And it's not even anything. It's like celebrated the 100th birthday.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I so want to talk more about that. And that's why I devoted a podcast series to that book. So sorry, that's a side note.
But. No, I completely agree with you guys.
I feel like it's an empty shell of what it used to be. It mm-hmm. used to be really cool. I'm not kidding. It used to be something kind of awesome. But I don't know. It's just not that today.
Covenant Sisters, such an awesome idea.
Sorry, I cut you off, Heather.
No, that's fine. I was just going to say that the whole time I was listening to the part about the trek and the men standing watching the women come up the hill and listening to Eyring's talk about what women should, they should be helping each other and instructing one another and all of that, it reminded me of what I've heard in the feminist Mormon, coming from the feminist Mormon housewife side of things about you don't have to tell people who are equal and valued that they're equal and valued. They know that, you know, and it seems like, and I think this is something that comes up every time there's a general women's meeting, but there's this constant reassurance. Don't feel bad about the things you're feeling bad about because you're valued and you're equal.
Well, I also get tired of how all Relief Society meetings are about the importance of service at some point. They always have to talk about how it's about giving service. And, you know, like I'm all about service, but why does it have to be made out to be a specifically female thing? Why does it, you know, why are women taught that their purpose is to serve? I find that to be kind of problematic. And granted, Elder Eyring did kind of say what I wanted to say, which is, you know, there are limits to service. You need mm-hmm. to know your limits and you need to know your boundaries and you need to know when you're giving too much. Like, don't give more than you can. But at the same time, I get tired of it, like this message of women, they're all about service. They just have to always give to other people.
Well, it's because you were born. You were born into that divine role. Didn't you know that, Elisa?
That's what I
got. You live for other people.
Yeah.
That's why I got frustrated with the primary voice. I hate to harp on this, but I mean, I kept telling my husband because he was just really frustrated with it this time. He's like, have you ever noticed that before? And I was like, have you not been listening to me the last 3 years talk about this? But I mean, the women, they look the same, they act the same, they talk the same. You couldn't distinguish their talks one from another. And that's great if you're that type of woman and you need that type of woman to look up to. But where's the diversity? You know, where's the strong female voice that we need? Not all strong voices have to come in the form of a strong feminine, motherly nurturer. There are other ways women can be strong too.
Yeah, I agree. I remember when I was a believer listening to women speak in general conference and thinking that I will never, ever fill that role. I'll never have that sweet, motherly, I'm comforter and not authority voice and persona. I just will never fit into that mold. So I think it is definite. But I mean, I think that's the church's, that's the mold we're supposed to fit into. As far as the church is concerned.
Thinking about the three of them in their meeting, talking that way to one another like that. I'm trying to make fun of them. I really am not, because I think that they are genuinely sweet, probably very wonderful giving women. But I think I struggle to think that it perpetuates this idea that women need to be that and we can't be real with each other.
Well, I would venture to say that they probably don't speak that way to each other. It's probably an affect they take on in public appearance.
And that's even more depressing.
But anyway, do we have anything else to say?
A bunch of honorary nitpickers, so.
Well, of course, we're disaffected. Well, I don't know how disaffected you are, Lindsay, but.
You've all.
Well, I was just going to say, thanks for letting me be my genuine, authentic, apostate self here on your podcast, Heather.
Well, you ladies are both welcome. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Priesthood Review session of the Mormon Expression / Mormon Expositor podcast. I'm Troy, Olson, the host for this short episode. And with us today, we have Sean. Hello, Sean.
Hey.
And we have a very special guest today, and that's Taylor, who is my 14-year-old son who went to priesthood with me last night, priesthood session. So how's it going, Taylor?
It's going very good.
Okay. So just as a brief introduction here for those who typically might be new to the priesthood session, haven't gone to the priesthood session. It's a, a special session of conference. It's one of the main sessions, but up until very recent times, the only way you could watch it was to go to your stake center or building. And being the priesthood session, of course, it's the only people that invited are those who hold the priesthood. But that includes Aaronic priesthood and Melchizedek priesthood holders. So all boys 12 and up are invited. In fact, they're encouraged to attend the priesthood session. And then all men who are priesthood holders and really all men in general, investigators or whatever. But now I just heard, though, I don't know, Sean, maybe you know about this, but I heard that you can actually watch the priesthood session now on LDS.org, that last night I noticed on a couple of the Facebook groups, people were saying, oh, I'm watching it right now on the internet. Did you know that?
I hadn't heard that, but probably, very likely. I live in Utah, as you know, so, here, it's we got stake centers around every corner, so it's pretty easy to get together. We've actually started some traditions here, call it tailgating, if you will. I think the one in our stake or area is called Brats and Brew, where pre-conference, they actually will cook brats on the grill and make homemade root beer. So it gets really wild and out of control. So
this is your ward or your stake?
My stake, yeah. And I don't remember, because the only time I've ever gone to priesthood in the East is, I served a mission in Pennsylvania. So it seems, though, that there were also, at least some food or events around General Conference and the Saturday, meetings, including priesthood, to keep people, at least in close proximity of the church. Do you still do that kind of thing out there?
What, say, to do what again? I misunderstood what you were saying.
Like a potluck or?
No, because now there's I live in Washington, D.C., and also I forgot to allow you to introduce yourself, but why don't you go ahead? This is my first hosting gig on this, so I'm stumbling all over myself. Why don't you introduce yourself, and then for full disclosure here, we'll go on. We just started. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, Troy and I are related, and maybe you can sense that, as you hear our voices, probably sound pretty similar. Yeah, my name's Sean Olson. I live near Salt Lake City. I've been here most of my life. I think I already mentioned I served a mission in Pennsylvania in the early 90s. What else?
That's good. We're brothers, yeah. So Sean and I are brothers, and we're both, one of the things the audience will want to know is kind of where we stand with the church. We're both active, but we both, Sean and I, like to talk about how we're West Bountiful Mormons. We have our own kind of view on the church, and we always have. But we both go to church. And so back to your question of, do they still do, I know what you're talking about. They would have potlucks at the stake center because everybody would come in. That's kind of gone the way of the dodo, mainly because of satellite and cable and the internet.
Right.
So it's, if you have any of those three mediums of communication in your home, you're golden for conference. It's pretty rare. They still do show the conference sessions at the stake center, but it's pretty rare that anyone actually shows up for those other than priesthood. And so, and that's kind of funny that you mentioned your brats and brews thing. It's, the priesthood session sort of has grown into all kinds of these traditions. What we do out here, my ward itself hasn't really stepped up to the plate to do anything, but they do a lot of things to sort of get the young men interested in coming. And again, up until maybe even this year, you had to go to the stake center to watch the session. You couldn't just watch it on the internet or on TV or whatever. So I noticed last night when we pulled into the stake center, there was one of the wards was off into the woods. It looked like they were cooking s'mores or something back there. And I know that another ward that I used to be in it's in the same stake we're in, but we moved, and so we're not in that ward anymore. They would, their tradition for years and years and years was to meet about half an hour before conference started there in the kitchen at the stake center and have kind of a Sunday bar, ice cream Sunday.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and then I know something that we've participated in, not so much me because I live in D.C. and not in Utah, but we go out to dinner with either Dad or with Dad and the brothers, or I don't know who you took to dinner last night, if it was just your boys. But Taylor and I, since Taylor's turned 12 a couple of years ago, we've been going out to dinner before the session. If you go in Utah, you go to a restaurant after the conference session, and probably 70% of the clientele in there are in white shirts and ties.
Yeah, I was trying to think last night how I could open a restaurant just for conference, for priesthood session, because the Chinese restaurant that we went to, you know, we waited forever and the food wasn't that great. But yeah, that's right. And I think another thing that always I notice, and it's gotten more and more common, is the exodus after the final amen of by, you know, whoever the president of the church is at the time. So, you know, when President Monson concluded his remarks last night, several brothers just, you know, immediately headed to the door at that point and to bypass the closing hymn and prayer, just to go so they could get to the restaurant and, you know, get a table. So that's an interesting new tradition we have.
I used to do the same thing before I started taking Taylor. I for years and years would go to priesthood by myself, living out here, and then just because I was by myself and I didn't really care, as soon as, like you say, as soon as President Hinckley or President Monson said amen, I was in the parking lot, and I was probably home before the final close was said.
Burning rubber.
Yeah, but since I have to set a good example for the boy here, we've been staying until the closing prayer and fighting the traffic and stuff. But because conference doesn't end until 10 o'clock out here.
Yeah, and then
first, so we just go home afterwards.
That reminds me of another thing to mention, and I hesitate to mention because it's actually kind of a gold nugget. And last night I couldn't get away with it because Dad was here, and he wouldn't go for it. But one of the great secrets of general priesthood is the mother's room. So at every stake center in the church, to my knowledge, there's a mother's room, an area where, you know, nursing mothers can go. And in our stake center here in Davis County, Utah, we actually have a TV that hooks to, you know, whatever the satellite broadcast might be. And in there are, I think there's two or three kind of lazy boy recliners. So if you don't, if you get there early, and now I've just let the cat out of the bag, you can find the mother's room vacant. Take your shoes off, loosen your tie, and kick back in the lazy boy, and turn the light off. So you heard it first here on the podcast, yeah. I guess.
Also, that's, I don't think I'd probably sleep through the whole thing, so you'd be able to stay home in bed for that.
Well, the two guys that were in the actually there are two recliners, because the two guys that were in there last night, both of whom I know, yeah, when I turned the lights on, they were both eyes closed, carried away in a vision, as it were.
All right, well, we got it. We better start reviewing the session.
All right, let's do it.
15 minutes in here. One more tangent I want to get to. I'm sure that the two groups that covered the Saturday morning and Saturday afternoon sessions covered this extensively, but I want to hear Taylor's reaction to this since he's 14. So, Taylor, what do you think about the announcement that they made yesterday that you can serve your mission now when you turn 18? You don't have to wait until you're 19, as long as you're a high school graduate.
Well, either way, I'm going to have to go when I'm 19, when I graduate from high school.
Well, or close enough, right?
Yeah, but I think that probably better so back families in the 20 instead of 21.
So you think it's a good announcement?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So what Taylor's, he started school when he was a little older, so, and I was in the situation too. The announcement wouldn't have affected me much either, because I was close to 19 when I graduated from high school anyway. So that's, Taylor will be in that situation. So what he's saying, I guess, is it probably won't affect him much. But so overall, you like the announcement?
Yeah, yeah, I'm all for it, man.
Okay.
Get me out there early.
So as of now, you're planning to embark in 2 years of service.
Yeah.
Okay. There's actually going to be a separate Mormon expositor recording on just the mission announcement, and I'm not sure if it's going to air before or after this, but stay tuned for that if this one airs first. So let's get to the session. it's okay that we've spent so much time talking about other things, because I think this was probably one of the most uneventful sessions of conference I've ever attended, particularly, I guess, in light of the big announcement that was made in the Saturday morning session. Not a whole lot happened at this session. There really weren't that many controversial talks. There really weren't that many spectacular talks. It was just sort of a run-of-the-mill session, so we'll blaze through this for those who missed it. The first talk was by the member of the Quorum of the Twelve, D. Todd Christofferson, not to be confused with D. Quan Dance Moves, although I'd like to see D. Todd do a Dance Moves tape. I think that'd be something to see.
Is that the dance tape from Napoleon Dynamite?
Yeah. D. Quan. Nice. Let's get D. Todd's Dance Moves.
Spilling Gatorade all over himself.
Yeah.
Afterwards.
That'd be something. So let's have Sean, maybe you can summarize what he was talking about quickly and any impressions you had from the talk.
Well, for me, this talk was really kind of directed towards, it touched on the youth or the young men and the older guys, but I think it was directed primarily at, maybe that with the new requirement of 18 as the year where one would qualify for missionary service, trying to get those age guys and maybe the guys that are 18 to 25, I'd call this kind of a slap in the head kind of talk, is the way I heard it, which was, you need to be men, get more serious about life, have a plan, apply yourself, do something that benefits society. And so it was kind of the grow up talk is what I heard.
Okay, yeah, I agree. I think there were some of those elements there. What I want to talk about more than the content of this talk is the structure of it, because this is something that, because of what I do for a living and I'm kind of interested in speaking and stuff, I sometimes get interested in how they structure these talks. And you'll see this a lot with the general conference talks, where they'll kind of set up a straw man at the beginning to attack. And the straw man that it seemed that Elder Christofferson set up was, he went through kind of all stages of the men who would be listening, starting with the young men. I think he set up a model of, okay, the young men who only seek entertainment, the young single adults who drift or kind of drifters and don't start families, like you talked about, Sean.
Mm-hmm.
Fathers who don't provide for their families, and then priesthood holders who waste their time on, he's mentioned two specific items, one, pornography, and two, just kind of cyberspace in general. And so I think he kind of set up this, and he threw in a little tidbit about, quoting somebody, or I can't remember, but he was talking about how in comparing men in college to women in college, and how women are outperforming men in college these days, and outperforming them in all kinds of, maybe all aspects of life. And so he painted this picture of the women in college are these very studious, people that are sitting in class, taking notes and working hard. And the young men in college are coming in with their, I think he actually specifically mentioned hats on backwards, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah. So, coming in with their hats on backwards. And I was picturing some guy like from a baseball game coming in with his hat on backwards, his baseball jersey that was open at the front, maybe with a Led Zeppelin shirt underneath or something, and kind of like, hey man, I'm just here for the chicks or something. And
yeah.
And I'm not sure that when I say straw man, I it's easy to set up these kind of all these loser types of men, Homer Simpson for the father, and this kind of loser college guy, and say, yeah, you don't want to be this. Well, of course you don't want to be that. But I don't know how many actual people really are that. I went to college, and I think that there are some of those guys, but for the most part, most of the people there are serious about it, and they realize they're either paying or somebody's paying for them to go through this experience, and their future career is dependent on it and how well they do. So they're not just sitting there doing nothing. But anyway, so he set that up, and then he kind of went through how to not be one of those guys. One of the things I wanted to ask Taylor about, he was in talking, contrasting kind of the young man who sits around playing video games all day with this story that he told about the 14-year-old kid in India who worked two jobs and also was going to school. And they actually, I guess there was some video he said that he saw that told this kid's story, and they were showing a few little clips from that. Did you have any reaction to that story, Taylor? What did you think about that?
I was thinking probably without that kid focusing, then the family would probably be like on the streets or something. They wouldn't really have any money or anything.
So that might be true. What about, did it make you think that you wanted to work harder, that you wanted to focus more on important things? Did it have any, did it make you think that you wanted to change anything about your life, really?
Well, yeah, it made me think that instead of playing video games or watching TV, I could help clean something or do some work in the yard, help out more.
All right. So mission accomplished, D. Todd. That's good. We'll take your help, Tim. That's right. You ought to be working two jobs and cleaning this dump up.
And I actually related more to the kid from India, Troy, growing up in West Bountiful. I think we both had two jobs.
I actually had three at one point. Oh, so
I kept thinking.
In fairness, though, Dad wasn't taking our money.
He wasn't. Yeah, that's true.
We were allowed to keep our earnings. Now, he wasn't giving us any money, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah. We... Yeah, that's funny. We actually had some audio difficulties during Elder Christofferson's talk, so I missed some of it. Another good part of it, we need to move on. One of the good stories he told, I guess he was retelling a story that Bishop Edgeley had told a while ago about the guy in Centerville who lost his job, who worked at an auto place, and then the quorum rallied around him, and someone knew about an old vacant barn that they turned into his auto shop, and they helped him to get back on his feet. And I thought, you know, that is a real positive message. And one of the great things about quorums that are serious about things rather than just kind of go and sit there and listen to the lesson and see how fast they can get home to the football game. I mean, there are quorums that I've been a part of where there's a real sense of belonging, a real sense of trying to take care of each other. So I thought that was a good story.
Yeah, and I know we need to move on, but I'd echo that as well. I mean, it seems to me like priesthood, and for lack of a better analogy, we kind of run drills every week. We talk about this stuff in church, but my experience has been whenever a crisis may actually present itself, I think you'd be hard pressed to match kind of the organization and, you know, actually getting people together to help, and those stories are, I think we all kind of, like I said, we're sitting and staging, you know, waiting for that kind of thing to come. But I've seen that we've had some really cool things here, and you know, last winter we had a major windstorm, which some of the listeners may be familiar with that live in this area, and effectively that Sunday church was canceled, and you know, the priest had just kind of assembled across the stake lines, and we went and, you know, cleaned up the whole county, so, and helped people out. So those are good stories to hear.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Let's kind of blaze through these next two talks, and then again, for people that aren't familiar with the priesthood session, the format for years has been the leadoff hitter is an apostle, so that was true here with D. Todd. Then you get generally a member of the presiding bishopric speaks, and that is the next speaker here, Gary Stevenson, who is the current presiding bishop. Then you get one of the members of the 70 who is going to have his one and only chance to speak in conference, and that was true again. And then that pretty much takes up the first hour, and then the last hour, maybe even longer, is the whole First Presidency speaks, and they speak at every priesthood session, all three of them. So we'll get to their talks later. So this next talk was by Gary Stevenson, the presiding bishop. And Taylor, do you want to quickly summarize what he talked about?
He was talking basically about courage and always you should write things, even if it's embarrassing. Like you said, he talked about the marijuana guys or whatever they were doing. He said if that guy didn't follow his beliefs, he would end his career and probably would have ended up on the streets. And he said, do we want to be quitters or do we want to be valiant and courage against all the evil in the world? And he said, what you do now will reflect on what you become. And he talked about how you should be become worthy in your quorums and have courage to say yes or no.
So do you remember who this talk was specifically directed to, who he said at the very beginning? Yeah, so another reason I wanted Taylor to participate is in priesthood session, there's always at least one talk, and usually maybe half the talks are directed to the young men of the Aaronic priesthood. And Bishop Stevenson got up and started off by saying, I'm going to talk to the young men. And he started off by talking about the Sons of Helaman in the Book of Mormon and the courage. And then I think Tara referred to them as the marijuana guys. Briefly, the story is there were some guys who really wanted to go to some prestigious school in Japan that were from the United States, I think, and from Canada, in North America somewhere. And they went, and there was some kind of a party on the rooftop. And I think he said as the evening wore on, the volume of the alcohol and music increased. So I'm not quite sure why they would turn the music up or what that would have to do with anything. But hey, the volume of the music increased. And then they all formed, what's that?
That's usually when the wheels come off.
Yeah. And then, well, exactly, that's what happened, because they all decided to form a circle, and lo and behold, someone broke out the marijuana cigarettes, as Bishop, Stevenson specifically, marijuana cigarettes, that's a term you don't hear every day, and they decided they were going to pass the marijuana cigarettes around in the circle, and apparently there were more than, I don't know if it was clear that these guys were LDS or if they were just upstanding American citizens or what, but there were a group of three of them, and the one kid wanted, he was going to exercise courage by leaving the premises, and the other two kids were kind of like, well, it doesn't matter if we leave, if we don't have to smoke it, because we've been here all night, basically, and we haven't been drinking at all, we're just kind of hanging out with the class, and when the marijuana cigarette comes to us, we'll just pass it to the, we'll pass the, what's that song? Pass the doy bitch on the left-hand side or whatever. Remember that song?
Yeah, I can't remember. Yeah.
So they're gonna do that, the doochin or whatever, I don't know. So they're going to pass it to the left and not partake. But the one kid said, no, we need to get the heck out of Dodge here. So he and one of the reluctant ones left. And lo and behold, as they were riding, I think he said as they were riding the elevator down, there were Japanese policemen on the elevator. I'm not sure what they were doing going down. They should have been going up.
No, they were going to get on the elevator, and then the police came out and took the elevator and started running up the stairs.
Oh, I see. Well, so I misheard. So, yeah, so the police went up and busted the whole operation, and the wise students threw their marijuana cigarettes off the top of the skyscraper. So that would have been nice if you're down on the pavement and the burning marijuana going in the head. But anyway, that's all I could think of.
Yeah.
That's bonus there. And then so they threw it all off, but the police, but they were no dummies. They lined them all up to smell the thumb and index finger of every member of the party. So that's another wonderful visual. And the one kid who, even though he didn't take a puff, his finger and thumb, I guess, smelled like the marijuana cigarette because he held it long enough to pass it. And he, along with all these other folks that had been smoking, were expelled from school, and yeah, they ended up in the gutter or whatever. And the two guys who left were all
great successes.
Thing, yeah. So the lesson is, Taylor, what's the lesson?
Don't smoke.
Anything else? Yeah. Anything else on Bishop Stevenson's talk?
I just chuckle. Evidently, this Japanese university had an honor code of sorts, but the volume increase, I remember thinking about the new caffeine stuff at BYU, and I thought, man, I wonder if they circle up for a monster or a rock star, Red Bull. And if you just pass the can, maybe you can stay in school. But point taken. I mean, the boys need to stay out of those situations, and clearly the best way to stay out of trouble is to stay as far away from it as you can. So, but I thought the story was, yeah, to your point, clearly Bishop Stevenson, wasn't at Woodstock, because he marijuana cigarette. It's like kind of like saying a hamburger sandwich, but yeah, decent talk.
All right, so then we had the next talk was Anthony Perkins of the 70, who I loved in Psycho, and he I'll summarize this one. I actually liked this talk quite a bit because he talked about kind of what he called the twin guardrails to protect yourself. He started off by talking about David from the scriptures, not David Cross, the star of Arrested Development, but David from the scriptures, and how he was this mighty priesthood holder, but he was even susceptible to temptation, and he ended up, you know, eventually falling. I think he said losing his soul and all this stuff. So he set up the what he called the twin guardrails of protection or to stay on the right track, sort of like a train track or something. And one is deep personal conversion, and two is strong family relations. Then he went through six fundamental principles to have those, but I'm not going to go into that. But I just think whether you're still active in the church, still in, or whether you're out, I think that you can kind of look at the situation and say, if you have those two sort of anchors, then it's harder to leave the church or to fall away or to, you know, whatever you want to call it. You know, if you're in it because you really, really believe it, then you're not, chances of you leaving are not great. Or two, you know, kind of as a backstop to that, if you're in it because your family is really into it and you don't want to disappoint your family by leaving, that's another way that you're going to stay. Now, we don't have time to debate maybe the pros and cons of those two guardrails and whether they're positive or negative, or for people that leave, how that can really mess up your family relationships. You know, we've talked about that on different episodes of Mormon Expression, Mormon Expositor. We'll talk about it in the future. But I just thought it was interesting that he actually specifically mentioned those two things, and whether you look at them from a positive or negative standpoint, I think we can all agree that if those two anchors are in place, it is hard to, or at least harder to, break away from the church, you know, for whatever reason. Let's move on, just because, unless Sean you had some great insight into something else.
No, I agree with what you said.
Good. Moving on to the three headliners of the evening, we had President Uchtdorf start off, and this was personally my favorite talk of the session, mainly because President Uchtdorf is not capable of giving a bad talk. I don't think he's, you know, he sticks to kind of general principles. He doesn't veer too far one way or the other. He doesn't really give controversial talks. He doesn't veer off into, you know, Boyd K. Packer type territory where he's calling a certain group or to repentance or saying a certain lifestyle or belief system or whatever is evil. He just kind of sticks with the main. Here's, you know, we're all here to be motivated and be better people. So I'm going to give you one of those talks. And he usually does a great job. You know, I'll quickly summarize this talk so we can kind of move, you know, put an amen to this wrap up session here. But he, again, as he often does, used an aviation analogy. Most of us all know that he, of course, was a former pilot before he got into the general authority business, and talked about the difference between flying a Piper Cub, which was an aircraft that was developed, I think he said, 35 years after the Wright brothers' first flight. He joked around that, you know, the Piper Cub was definitely not built for speed. And then he talked about a recent experience he had of, I don't know if he said he was flying or just flying with one of the pilots in an F-18 fighter jet. Those are the planes that the Blue Angels, the Navy's kind of showcase fighter team flies around in. And he's also very funny and very personable. He just always gives a good talk. And he joked around about how the Piper Cub was a slow ride and very enjoyable because it was so slow, and he was driving it, or flying it, I guess, with his son over the Autobahn in Germany, and how all the cars on the Autobahn were outpacing the Piper Cub. And then he joked that when he got in the F-18, his age became very apparent, because it's not the G-forces and hairpin turns and things that you experience in an F-18 are not meant for a man of his age or something, you know. But his point was that as priesthood holders, we have different experiences. Oh, he said he didn't enjoy the Piper Cub or the F-18 experience really one more than the other. He said they were both very enjoyable experiences. So he went on to say it's sort of like priesthood holders, we have different opportunities to serve. And he said, like, for those of you in a ward in Utah, maybe that's the F-18 type of an experience where every calling and then some are completely filled with active members, and as opposed to if you're living in some area in the world where your ward's very small, maybe just a couple of families, you kind of struggling along like the Piper Cub. But I mean, in either situation, there's plenty of opportunities to serve, and you should just kind of sit back and try and look for those opportunities to help other people, not to complain about, and just be happy and look for ways you can help other people. Any other thoughts on President Duke Dorstoff? Taylor, I'm calling on you. What do you think about
that? Thank you. Did a good job talking about it. He said that we need to deepen our faith in Jesus, even if we are in a small world, and if it's hard to be active in your calling. He said to commit each day to serve and to make faith perfect through discipleship. So basically, no matter what size your ward is, or if you're a Piper Cub or F-18, you still need to have responsibilities, and you should still.
All right, yeah, so that's good. Any thoughts on this, Sean, before we move to the next one?
No, I think you hit on all the points. I think the magic of President Ukdorf is, I think, his perspective. He just comes from a much different background, it seems, than a lot of your other members of the 12. And so I think his talks are always really refreshing because they're really inclusive, and they try to speak to, all different facets of the church, if you will, across the globe, not just, maybe the guys that are from Brigham City, nothing against them. But I really enjoy what he has to say, and I usually think he's spot on.
Yep. Everybody loves the Ukdorf, especially the ladies. All right. So the next was Henry Eyring. And maybe Sean, you can summarize it. I found myself dozing off in this one, actually.
Well, and I'm probably not going to be much good to you there either, Troy, because this one I had to excuse myself to use the restroom, as it were. So I do recall one thing I did catch on that, and I guess it struck a chord with me, was because I have some boys as well, and one of them is a little on the shyer side. So he talked a little bit about one of his boys, as I recall, that was, a little more introverted and shy, and working with him to, help him be more bold, prepared to be a missionary. So, but other than that, I was kind of in and out on that talk. So maybe Taylor can give us a summary.
Well, I don't have much on it, but he was talking about doing the Lord's work, and I remember he was talking about to stand up what you believe in and to be bold as a lion. He also said, and to fulfill your duties, not only in the mission field, but also in your family and your home, and to read the scriptures as a family and pray about gifts we've been given.
Yeah, he was talking about how for each one of his sons, he carved some kind of a board that they, I don't know if they put it on their wall or something, and I think it had their name, and then he would carve different things in it that would symbolize some of the things they'd done together, or things that they were good at, their talents, or things to motivate them. And he talked about when they were living in Idaho, he was the president of RICS, I think, at one point, Elder Eyring, or President Eyring was. And he and one of his sons went up and hiked one of the Teton Mountains there, and they didn't make it all the way up because the kid was 12, and he, those are big mountains. And so he was saying, Dad, that we didn't make it to the top. And this was one of President Eyring's patented kind of where he half tears up and kind of points with his whole hand out in the audience while he does that. And he says, I was not disappointed because you won't be disappointed. This is something we've done together. And he like carved an eagle into that kid's board so that he could remember that experience. But the whole talk didn't really tie together that well. I think that he was trying to use this analogy with the boards as a way to let people that work with young men, either fathers or priesthood leaders or whatever, giving them some kind of, I think he was trying to talk about different ways to motivate the kids or something, but I'm just wasn't quite sure. So anyway, nice story about the boards. So then it wrapped up, the session wrapped up as it always does with President Monson. And I thought he'd say more about the change in age of the missionaries, but he really didn't. Did he say anything about that? I don't remember him mentioning it.
I don't remember that either. And I thought that it's the reason, well, in my mind, I thought the reason they were announcing this right out of the gate with the temple announcements, which was, you know, Saturday morning session, which is pretty customary, was that it would set up, you know, a subsequent talk in priesthood, right? Somebody that would then address, you know, now you can go a year earlier, guys, so you really need to turn up the volume on preparation. But he didn't mention that. But I did think his talk was good. Troy, if you want me to kind of give
you... Yeah, go, do it, yeah.
So what I thought was refreshing again is, and it seems like the church is starting to, I mean, there's always been the invitation to come back, if you will, which usually, which several times has been delivered by Elder Scott and is never really, his delivery style hasn't always resonated with me, but the pleading, you know, please come back, but.
Whatever do you mean, Sean?
Yeah. Yeah, so, but, you know, President Monson talked about in his early days as a member of the 12 or as a general authority, visiting, going to a state conference in Alberta, Canada with N. Eldon Tanner, and which I guess President Tanner had lived there, you know, early years before. And during the state conference, I guess the four brothers that stood up to be sustained to receive the Melchizedek priesthood were all Jack Mormons, evidently, at one point. And to President Tanner's surprise, these guys were coming back or were now becoming active in the church and were ready and prepared, worthy, I guess, to become elders. So, you know, he talked about, you know, that men can change. He said that about, I don't know, four or five times with kind of an exclamation point and allowing people to make those changes, to be again more inclusive and to break free of maybe our culture of one size fits all, but rather there's diversity in the church just like anywhere else, and we need to be patient and more understanding with folks and let them progress and take their journey, you know, however it suits them. That was my take from his remarks.
Yeah, I want to pick up on some of the things you said. This isn't so much about the talk itself, but this is really interesting, I think, that I think in the minds of the brethren or the church, they don't quite understand maybe the realities of what I'll call apostasy. I think that they, in their minds, equate, you know, you mentioned Jack Mormons, that in their minds, and in fact, I think President Monson was specifically said at one point that everybody within the sound of my voice has a testimony or something. You just might have forgotten it. It might be weak. It might be, I don't know, something like that. But, and so I think that's true for your traditional Jack Mormon. And as I understand, we'll have to have a podcast. I think we have one, and on the expositor, a whole podcast on Jack Mormons and what that means and who they are. But it's my understanding that your general Jack Mormon is somebody who actually still believes in the church. They just, for whatever reasons, don't choose to live the standards at that time in their life. And I think the model that President Monson and really the church in general uses for reactivation works for the most part for those folks, because if they still believe in the church's truth claims, but they just need some kind of a support system to overcome a word of wisdom problem or whatever, I think that that model works great to get those people back. The problem is, and a lot of our audience is going to resonate with this, if you actually really have lost your testimony, if you no longer believe that the church is true or that, you know, whatever, the gospel's not true, that you've lost your belief or faith in the church's truth claims, I'm not sure that kind of being the buddy, you know, if the ward comes out or your quorum comes out to be your buddy, if that's really going to get you back. Because you just, you're not starting from the same point. And so maybe if anyone in the church is listening, if you want to get those folks back, you know, I think the only way to do it is to be more accepting of other alternate beliefs, or to just say, we're happy to have you serve in whatever capacity you want or be a part of this, and we really don't care what you believe. But I doubt that you're going to hear that message in conference anytime soon. Anyway, Taylor, any thoughts on President Monson's talk before we wrap this up?
Well, before he ended, he said the responsibility on us. But what I think he meant by that is we have to find the people who aren't really active in our wards and try and bring them back to come to church and to try and become more active.
So you think that was a good idea? Something yeah. You want to do?
Yes.
Oh. All right, well, that should wrap it up. We've been going for quite a while here. So any final thoughts, anybody?
None for me. We'll see what today brings at conference.
Oh, Taylor, who gave the closing prayer?
Scorpion Man.
I forgot the guy's name, Elder Kiernan or something like that. He's the guy who gave that talk about how he went out in flip-flops in the Egyptian.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever, and he thought he stepped on a thorn, but it was actually a scorpion. That talk was kind of famous. That was Taylor's first priesthood session. He liked that talk, and then that dude later came out and talked in our state conference, and Taylor was so impressed he went right up to the front to meet the guy to shake his hand. So when he got up to say the prayer, Taylor was all pumped. It was like his like his buddy Scorpion Man was up there giving the closing prayer.
I was just pleased that he didn't give a closing talk.
His prayer was what, a minute?
Yeah, it was perfect.
Yeah. That's all general authorities who are within the sound of my voice, if you get called on to give the prayer in conference, that does not mean you should have been giving a talk. I know you might feel bad that you didn't get called on to speak, but please don't favor us with the sermon. Put an amen to it and let us get something to eat.
If they have to cue your prayer up on the teleprompter, it's too long.
So there you go. Words of wisdom from the Olson boys to the general authorities. Okay, so thank you very much, Sean and Taylor, for being on this session, and hope all you listening in enjoy the rest of our conference recaps. Thanks,
guys.